Engaging conversation on the most urgent problem of our day and what you can do about it.
Now, the End Abortion Podcast by Priests for Life.
Well, hello, friends. Father Frank Pavone here, National Director of Priests for Life. Welcome to endabortion.tv, our broadcasting program for Priests for Life. One of our medical advisors and a longtime friend is Dr. Anthony Levitino. Now, if you follow the pro-life movement, you will likely be familiar with his name because he is a board-certified obstetrician and gynecologist, but also used to perform abortions. And he will tell us a little bit about that. But we are going to talk to him in particular today about late-term abortion and about the controversy that has renewed itself here in our country as a result of actions taken in New York State and bills introduced in a number of other states as well. Dr. Levitino is both a physician and a lawyer, has training in both of those areas, and uses his expertise in both of those areas to bring that knowledge and experience to bear on the effort in our nation to restore protection to the children in the womb. So, Dr. Levitino, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, and thanks so much for coming on with us today.
Great talking to you, Father Frank.
So just for those who may not know your story, in a nutshell, you, of course, have a very compelling testimony of how at one time you did perform abortions and then realized that this was not the right thing to do.
Yes. As I often tell people, in 1976, when I graduated from medical school, if you had asked me how I felt about the abortion issue, I wouldn't have hesitated for a minute to tell you that I was pro-choice. This was a decision between a woman, her doctor, and no one, including the baby's father, had anything to say about it. A lot of people identify themselves as pro-life or pro-choice. For many, it's just some vague political opinion, or it may or may not affect how they vote. But when you're an obstetrician gynecologist and you say that you're pro-choice, now it's not some vague political decision, it's whether you're going to do abortions or not. Mm-hmm. And I learned to do abortions in my residency training program. After graduating from that program, and we did both first trimester DNC abortions and saline abortions at the time, rare prostaglandin abortions. Those were troublesome because you often got living children, and that was a no-no. After I went into practice, my partner and I saw an opportunity as abortionists, and we weren't running an abortion clinic. This was a routine OBGYN office, like most women have gone to, but abortion was part of our practice. And we taught ourselves to do second trimester D&E abortions, and I did those for a number of years. Over the next four years, I performed over 1,200 abortions, including over 120 D&E abortions up to 24 weeks.
You know, you mentioned about the 24-week time frame, and this is where I still find that so many of our fellow citizens are not even aware that abortions are done that late in pregnancy. And of course, as we know, they're done even after that. From the perspective of what you know about what is going on with abortion in America, tell our viewers about the prevalence of what we would call late-term abortion and how late-term abortion can actually be.
Well, late-term abortion itself, when we talk professionally, is not a, quote, professionally recognized term. So I tend to talk about second trimester abortions. Those start at 13 weeks from last menstrual period up to about 27 weeks from last menstrual period. And then third trimester abortion from 27 weeks of gestation all the way up to term at 40 weeks. A lot of people are simply not aware of the existence of these late-term abortions because, in a very great way, it's been hidden for the last 40-plus years since Roe versus Wade. If you ask most people to name a Supreme Court decision, 99% of people will say Roe versus Wade. Mm-hmm. I swear most people probably don't know of any other decisions. but most people have never heard of Doe versus Bolton. You see, Roe set up a trimester framework that was consistent with medical care as it was in 1973. Things have changed in the last 46 years. But back then, a baby in the third trimester, 27 weeks on, could survive, was regarded as viable. And Roe said that an abortion could, that a state, if it wished to, could outlaw abortion in the third trimester so long as the mother's health was not affected. Now, who could be against health? But the problem was, and all the lawyers appreciate this, Roe did not define the word health. Doe versus Bolton, this companion case, did. And it mean, and what it told us was that health includes a woman's physical health, not telling us how badly a physical health had to be affected. It included her mental health, again, not telling us how badly affected her mental health had to be. It included her economic health, without telling us how rich someone has to be to justify a third trimester abortion, or poor in that case. And it also included her social health. What in heaven's name is that?
Right.
As an illustration, I've mentioned, this was a real case. I had a 17-year-old come to me once for her fifth abortion. And she was very, and we always very carefully counseled our patients. And she was very clear that the reason she wanted the abortion was that she wouldn't be pregnant during her senior prom. I guess that's a definition of her social health. When you take all those exceptions together, an abortion could be done all the way up to term. And this is what we're seeing in the new laws that are coming out now.
You know, you yourself, in other words, are telling us that this was the reason that your patient came to you for an abortion, to be able to take part in the senior prom.
That was her reason at the time, yes.
Yeah. Because, you know, I pause to emphasize that because so many people say to us, pro-life advocates, oh, that's ridiculous. People don't do that. And of course, as you'll recall in the third debate in the 2016 presidential race that Donald Trump had with Hillary Clinton, when he brought up the abortions in the very latest stages of pregnancy, she responded with a line that the abortion advocates so often use. She said, well, this happens in situations where there are these terrible medical conditions that the mother and or the baby will face. Now, we have done, and various other groups have done, undercover phone calls into abortion facilities where we've had people successfully book appointments after they told the clinic that their baby was healthy and that they were healthy, successfully book these appointments at 30 and 32 weeks of pregnancy. This is going on. This is happening. We want to talk with you a little bit about the, when the other side does say, oh, well, this is happening for complicated medical reasons. We know that it happens when the baby is healthy and the mother is healthy. But let's address their concerns about medical complications because, you know, you and I have had these conversations over the years, and it's important that our viewers understand what can be done with a medical complication in pregnancy that takes care of both the mother and the baby, two patients, not just one. And of course, you have experience in this area. Tell us about why it is just erroneous to think that an abortion, that is the direct killing of the baby, is necessary to preserve a mother's life or health.
For almost 10 years, I worked in what is referred to as a tertiary referral center. These are hospitals that have the resources, both professional and otherwise, to care for really high-risk pregnancies. And I saw it all. Severe preeclampsia toxicity. Situations where the pregnancy was threatening the mother's life. I did this on a regular basis for almost 10 years. And the vast majority of those kind of complications occur in the late second trimester or third trimester when the baby is viable. And the point has to be made. The pregnancy is what's threatening her, not the baby. And I cared for hundreds of women. I saved hundreds of women in these kind of very complicated, serious complications of pregnancy, and did not have to kill a single child in the process. The perfect example, a woman came in with severe preeclampsia, which many of your listeners understand means severe high blood pressure in pregnancy, combined with some other problems, protein in the urine and some other things. A normal blood pressure is 120 over 80. Her blood pressure at 27 weeks gestation, she presented to the hospital with a severe headache, and her blood pressure was 220 over 160.
Wow.
She was 4 hours away from a stroke. We admitted her, stabilized her, did a cesarean section within an hour, and she and the baby did just fine. Now, let's say we wanted to use abortion to, quote, save her life, which is what you often hear in that situation. An abortion in the third trimester, which is where 27 weeks is, will take several days just to prepare the cervix to be able to perform the abortion. The entire process can take up to a week. When someone comes in with a blood pressure of 220 over 160, you don't have a week to solve the problem. If you wait a week, she'll be dead. If you wait a day, she'll probably be dead. And that's why this pablum that we need late-term abortion, quote, to save women's lives, in the vast, vast majority of cases, is sheer rubbish. It's the pregnancy that threatens her, not the baby. So end the pregnancy. That doesn't mean you have to end the baby. In fact, you really can't. You don't have time to do that in a true emergency.
This is a crucially important point, the distinction between ending the pregnancy versus killing the baby. Ending the pregnancy, whereby the physician knows he has two patients and he's caring for them both, doing his best for them both. Dr. Leventino, we'll be back after this break. We want to probe into this a little bit more deeply and also talk with you about how early in a pregnancy a baby is likely to survive if delivered early. We'll get some of the latest insights about that from you. But we'll be back, my friends, with Dr. Tony Leventino right after this break.
Clear. That was great. We're going to continue. Father, you ready?
Yep, ready.
All right. Stand by. Want to start with just Father on one shot, John, and then go back to the two shot? Let's start with Father on the one shot so it breaks it up. There's no continuity. Change it. All right, Father, stand by. 5, 4, 3.
Well, hi, friends. Welcome back. Father Frank Pavone here, a National Director of Priests for Life. We're talking with one of our medical advisors, Dr. Anthony Leventino, board-certified obstetrician gynecologist. He is also a lawyer. He is also a professor of medicine. He has done some teaching in this area and used to perform abortions for a while, and is a great advocate within the pro-life movement to educate people about abortion. And right now we're talking specifically about the area of medical complications in pregnancy. And before the break, we made the clear distinction with Dr. Leventino's assistance here in between situations where a baby needs to be delivered early because the pregnancy itself, the process of pregnancy, may be causing a threat to the mother's life or health. A distinction between ending the pregnancy early versus directly killing the baby, which is what an abortion is. So, Dr. Leventino, if we're understanding this correctly, is it true to simply say that killing the baby, ending the baby's life, does not in and of itself bring any medical benefit?
There is no known medical condition of the mother that is improved by killing the baby. There's no indication to kill a child in order to treat the mother in a problem pregnancy.
Now, let's look at this from the point of view of the child. If it's perfectly morally legitimate, which of course it is when you're dealing with two different patients and you're doing your best to help them both, if you have to deliver the baby early, let's talk about the probability of success. that child will survive. I remember, Sandra Day O'Connor decades ago talking about how Roe v. Wade was on a collision course with itself because the age of viability was getting earlier and earlier. And this would clash, of course, with Roe v. Wade saying, well, the state can't interfere with an abortion in the earlier stages of the pregnancy. Tell us now, how early can a baby be delivered with a reasonable hope of survival?
That quotation that you used from Sandra Day O'Connor is one of my favorites because it's exactly the point. As I said earlier, Roe set up this trimester framework that was valid in terms of viability 46 years ago. Medical science has not just stood still in the last 46 years. At this point, the age of viability is generally accepted as 22 weeks from last menstrual period. That's 20 weeks from conception. The dating gets a little confusing. Professionals date from the last period. Yes, we know she wasn't pregnant back then, but it's a date that we can point to. And given that, pregnancy is term due at 40 weeks. Even the WHO now recognizes 22 weeks as the age of viability. Now, not all children will survive at 22 weeks. On the other hand, some actually earlier will survive. I've heard of survivals down around 20 weeks. But that is the stage of current medicine when proper care is given to that child. And this is where the new laws are so troubling. New York's new law, the Reproductive Health Act, legalized abortion in New York is unrestricted up to 24 weeks. And then beyond 20 weeks, still term, it's allowed. There's a health exception, same thing we've been dealing with for years. They've really put into statute what's been going on for years. Mm-hmm. Vermont, they don't even bother. There's no limit to abortion at any time during pregnancy period. End of story. Virginia, we know that whole situation, same thing. They used the health exception for the late stages. That one was defeated in committee. But we know of the difficulties that the Governor Northam has had in Virginia with the statements he's made on the radio. But that's the current state of affairs.
When we talk about the ability of the baby to survive an early delivery, as you said, 22 weeks, even 20 weeks in some cases, the main issue is the health of the lungs, isn't it? The strength and the development of the baby's lungs?
That's the biggest issue. There are several issues. And the earlier in gestation that these babies are born, more difficult it is for them. Fetal lung maturity is the single largest factor, though. And again, and the reason why viability is getting down is we're getting better and better at treating the complications of prematurity, including the lack of the lungs. The lungs are stiff. It's very difficult to breathe in those early stages. And children lack something called surfactant. It's a natural substance we all make that allows us to breathe easier. Well, now we have synthetic surfactant as one factor that helps these children survive. And it's that kind of advance, as well as many, many others, that have contributed to the decreasing age of viability.
So there are medications, aren't there, that can be given to the mother to enhance, or I don't know if it's to speed up the development of the lungs, if we know that this baby might have to be developed early. And then, of course, after delivery, there are all kinds of things we can do to help that child breathe as those lungs continue to develop, right?
That is true. It's been a standard of care for many, many years to treat women in situations where a premature delivery is anticipated. If you have time, remember, depending on the state of the emergency, but if you can get 24 hours out of that pregnancy before you end the pregnancy, I hate to even use the word terminate, they've stolen the word.
Yeah.
You can treat that woman with steroids. This has been a standard of care for many, many years that will, as you say, essentially speed up the maturation of the lungs and allow the child to breathe easier after delivery.
Dr. Levitino, a final question, which I guess is a cluster of questions. People have been looking at what happened in New York. They heard this interview with the governor of Virginia, and they've heard, and if they've been following what we've been saying, they've been hearing for years and years about these situations where a baby is born alive and then is killed by the abortionist, or just left to die, killed by neglect. And of course, as we know, Kermit Gosnell is in jail for having done this multiple times, killing the baby outside the womb. And Congress, of course, is dealing with this now, legislation, even as we speak, being introduced and debated considered, that would make it very clear that a baby born alive needs to be protected. I think a lot of people are, you know, first of all, aside from simply not believing that this actually happens, I think people then, when they realize, yes, this is a problem, ask themselves, well, of what benefit in the world could it possibly be to that abortion practitioner to either kill that baby or just neglect that baby until the baby dies? From your perspective, your knowledge of the medical situations, but also having been in the abortion industry yourself, give us some kind of insight into, I mean, why, again, what benefit could it possibly be at that point for them not to want to save that baby?
It's interesting you use the word benefit. It's not just a benefit, it's a necessity. And this is a fine, fine distinction in the law that most people, non-professionals, do not understand. Even some professional physicians do not understand the distinction. When I did a presentation about this in medical school just 2 weeks ago, and I picked a student and I asked him a very simple question. Are you a human being? And he said, yes. And I said, well, how do I know? Well, the answer to that question is that he's a human being by scientific definition. I'm an animal that looks this way, has 46 human chromosomes, blah-de-blah, okay? But, and I asked that same student, his name was Ishmael. I said, so Ishmael, are you a person? And he said, yes. And of course I said, how do you know? And then, of course, the next question before he even answered, I said, so what is the difference between a human and a person? The answer, which he stumbled with because he didn't know, was that a person has rights. And then I explained that in law, there are only two things in the entire universe: people, persons, and property. And then, of course, I asked the next question, Ishmael, has there ever been a time when human beings were property? And of course, that answer he knew right away. Well, yes, it's slavery. Oh, so persons or human beings can be property. The fact is that we all become persons under the law at birth. And this becomes the key to what we're talking about. If an abortionist, Gosnell was a perfect example, delivers a child and that child is alive, the moment that child is born, that is a person under the law who has rights. And if you kill a person under the law, that is called murder. And that's exactly what Dr. Gosnell did. So it is, and this is, again, becomes incredibly important. You must kill the child before it is born. And this is why we're talking about literally, you know, even despite the conversations, as you mentioned earlier, well, these cases are only done in very severe cases of serious malformations. They don't know that. They're speculating. There's no one overseeing this whole process. Look at all of these laws that are coming out now. The decision is between the woman and her doctor. There's no mention in the statutes of any oversight by the state, any oversight by the hospital. And we're told that we should trust the doctor and the woman in these decisions. But you see, an abortion must be, to be accomplished legally, the child must be killed before delivery. You can picture a situation where the head is literally visible in the vagina coming down the birth canal. Nothing in these laws, by the language of the law itself, prevents a doctor from taking an instrument, piercing the skull, sucking out the brains, and then delivering the rest of the baby. It is legal under these laws, by the language of the laws, because the laws provide no oversight or supervision whatsoever. Nothing. And again, as far as we have to trust doctors and women, another example that I can point to because it involves me. Years ago, when my partner and I were doing abortions in upstate New York, one of the hospitals that we practice out of did not want abortions in their hospital. They just didn't like that. So we negotiated with them. And we got them to agree that the only abortions we would do, because we promised the only abortions we would do would be medically necessary abortions. They didn't understand the law. We did. So from that day on, every single abortion I did in that hospital, I wrote in the chart, I certified that this abortion is medically necessary and signed my name. Now, the minute anybody, and they tried to, well, you're going to have to tell us what the medical necessity is. And then I said, no. That's a matter of patient privacy. You have no right to that information. And we just did all the abortions we wanted to with no restriction. That's at least one example that I can point to because it's personal of, really, you're going to trust physicians and women who are driven by many, many reasons to have abortions, many reasons. It can be a very difficult decision. And you're going to trust a financially interested doctor to say yes or no with no supervision. That's what these laws say.
You know, one of the undercover calls we did, the caller was told, and this was a very late abortion, that it would cost $25,000. As you mentioned before, I mean, these, you're getting into multi-day procedures, right? Because there's the dilation of the cervix and there's all kinds of things that have to happen. It's unbelievable. I think most people hear that and say, you got to be kidding. But it's happening. And I think that's a very important insight that you give, that if that doctor says this was medically necessary, you know, nobody's got to ask him what the medical necessity was.
It, you know, a statute could be written requiring that, but they simply have chosen not to do that.
That's right. Exactly. Well, we're so, going yeah, to look
tell
forward.
Tell me all day long how rare these procedures are. I'm going to sit there and say, under your statute.
Yeah.
You're not specifying anything about this whatsoever. All you're saying is it's legal.
Exactly. Well, we look forward to keeping in contact with you as this debate intensifies. I think certainly now, you know, a lot of information has come to the attention of the public that, you know, you and I have known for decades, but so many of our fellow citizens have not. And I think now we've entered into a whole new stage of the abortion debate in this country. I think in many ways, it's the beginning of the debate. I mean, I often say to people, you know, it has looked like we've been debating abortion all these decades. But if a person doesn't even know the basic facts of what's going on, how can they really have a debate about whether it should be going on? But now I think in many ways the debate is really starting in earnest because people are starting to see things that they had no idea were going on. So we're grateful to you for helping expose the reality of this, for advocating for the babies in such a medically and legally informed way. We're glad to have you as one of our medical advisors at Priests for Life, and we certainly look forward to continuing the conversation.
My pleasure, Father Frank, and I agree with you completely. The new laws, if nothing more, are making people aware of what's really been going on for a long time, and they're seeing it in a new light. And I think if there's anything good to come of this, that's where it starts.
That's where it starts. Friends, Dr. Anthony Levitino, we are grateful to him, and we're grateful to all of you for tuning in to endabortion.tv. This is Father Frank Pavone, Director of Priests for Life. God bless you, and we will talk to you soon.
This has been the End Abortion Podcast. To learn more, to help end abortion, and to connect with us on social media, visit endabortion.net.